This is Robert Stark, and I'm joined here today with Professor Paul Gottfried. We're going to be discussing his article that was up on a Radix Journal about Alexander Dugin and Martin Heidegger. And we're also going to be discussing basically the slam piece against Dugin over at the National Review. Professor Paul Gottfried, and it's nice having you on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So, since we're on the topic of Dugin, what was your original introduction to Alexander Dugin and his ideas?
Well, to be honest, that until I read his book on Heidegger, which Nina translated, the wife of Richard Spencer, I didn't know that much about him. I did, however, hear that he was an advocate of a Eurasian alliance against American hegemony, that he was a Russian nationalist who had supposedly a friendly relation with President Putin, and that he had written a book called The Fourth Political Theory, which was an argument in favor of creating some kind of alternative to what he sees, what Dugin sees as three failed political theories, communism, fascism, and what he sees as American liberal democratic hegemony. That's all that I knew about the man.
Have you read The Fourth Political Theory?
I've only read it in part. There also is a summing up of some of the main arguments of that in his book on Heidegger. In fact, the last part of the book on Heidegger deals with his interest in creating a political theory that is true to what he sees as the ontic nature, the ontological nature of man, and would fit the Heideggerian criteria, you know, meaning I'm not sure that necessarily with his discussion of Heidegger, but it is introduced toward the end of that work as a statement, what might say, as an alternative to the present order.
And you're saying both men, they sought out alternatives to the materialistic and consumerist ethos of late modernity. I think it's important to also to stress the term liberalism is by liberalism, Dugin means modernity, the system of basically liberal democracy, globalization, mm-hmm. consumerism. He doesn't necessarily mean liberalism in the sense that Fox News would.
No, absolutely not. I think he is producing a critique, one might say, of historical liberalism, a subject on which I wrote my book, After Liberalism, which came out with Princeton in 1999. And there I try to set out premises in the conditions in which what I call bourgeois liberalism developed, or classical liberalism. Again, classical liberalism is not the same as libertarianism. It is rather the liberal culture of the 19th century bourgeoisie and the political assumption, the moral assumption of that class order. And I think that actually Dugin's criticism goes well beyond what we mean by liberal democracy and is, you know, at the end of the day, a critique of all liberalism, which is based on the autonomy or any doctrine based on the autonomy of the individual.
Yeah, because the libertarians usually say that libertarianism and classical liberalism are synonymous.
Which they're not. That's something I've been arguing unavailingly for the last 40 years. They're just like, there's no way that you can pry loose these political terms from the cluster of misconceptions in which they're embedded. No, I'll say that modern liberalism is also clearly something that Dugin would oppose, because although it is collectivist and statist, it is also based on the effort to free individuals from any kind of traditional social context, family, gender roles, heterosexuality, whatever, that modern liberalism is, if from his point of view, and I think he's justified, by the way, in believing this, it is an extreme statement of all the positions of 19th century liberalism, which in the 19th century were not as extreme because they were circumscribed by family relations, patriarchy, Protestant Christianity, or whatever. So one might say the really radical potential of liberalism was not really evident in the 19th or even the early 20th century. But we see now, and I think Dugin would argue this, and Heidegger and others would make this argument, is liberalism in all of its ugliness. And this is what Dugin is reacting against.
A lot of the critics of Dugin would describe, well, he openly says that he rejects classical. Does he? Well, first of all, does he explicitly reject classical liberalism?
I think as he understands classical liberalism, he rejects classical liberalism. I think by now it is pretty much of an empty gesture, in my view, since the kind of liberalism that he's rejecting has been transformed a number of times. It is no longer classical liberalism. What it is a much more radical form of liberalism than any that existed in the 19th century. So to say that, you know, you're against liberalism because, or you're against any ideology because you oppose it, you know, in its root form, may not be a particularly, you know, what should we say, compelling statement, since the original form that these ideas took, you know, they've moved beyond. So that I think something like the gay liberation movement or feminism represents liberalism in a much more radical form than anyone in the 19th century who was a liberal probably could have believed, unless you include somebody like John Stuart Mill, who was not really a 19th century liberal. He's a social democrat and a feminist. But sort of normative 19th century liberals were typically not in favor of letting women vote. They believe in male dominance in society. They certainly would have kept gays somewhere in the closet or worse. So I'm not sure that, you know, attacking classical liberalism is necessarily an effective tactic at this point.
Yeah, I mean, very few people today would fit the category of like a pure classical liberal from the era of the founding fathers or that came out of the Enlightenment.
Right.
But it's important to point out about Dugin is his views very much were shaped by the Cold War. And that actually really fascinates me. I want to ask you about this because you were very active in the 1980s conservative movement. And back then,
right,
a lot of the original paleoconservatives, they've changed their tune, but back then, men like Pat Buchanan were supportive of the Cold War when it was during the Reagan era.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, people ask me, was it a mistake? And I would say that sort of given what we knew at the time, it was not a mistake, and that the Soviet Empire was actually very nasty. The problem is that the victor in the Cold War was not Western Christian civilization. It was the left, you know, and as I've argued in my books, the cultural Marxist left that wins the Cold War and takes power. I mean, the Soviet garrison state Marxists were cleared out of the way, the left became much more radical and also became permeated Western society. So that now you hear neoconservative writers, the Wall Street Journal writers, complaining that Putin is anti-Western because the West stands for homosexual rights. Well, as far as I know, during the Cold War, the struggle for the West was not over homosexual rights. And if you go back to the 1950s, paleoconservatives did not think that they were fighting for, you know, global democracy or human rights. They were fighting to defend their civilization against the godless communist aggressors. So I think the nature of the confrontation with the Soviets has changed. That, however, was not necessarily apparent to conservatives in the 1980s. And, you know, sort of looking back, I think we're right to oppose the Soviet Union was at the time.
And you, yeah, you have this article from the National Review, and this is an article against Dugin. What do they call Dugin's Evil Theology by Robert Zubrin.
Yeah. It's a curious article because Zubrin is not an historian. He knows beans about history. He's some kind of strange cosmologist who is interested in settling people on Mars or something like that. And but the article shows a certain kind of neoconservative cast of mind that although he's attacking Dugin, it's always the fault of the Germans. And German political theorists are Nazi political theorists, including, I see, Möller Vandenbroek, who died in 1925 and explicitly attacked the Nazis and called for Russo-German friendship. But he, too, is specified as a Nazi political theorist. Carl Schmitt is thrown in there for good measure. It is a totally ridiculous article, particularly in view of the fact that Dugin, in parts of the fourth political theory that I've read, attacks the Nazis, you know, saying these were evil people and we don't want to go back to this. To accuse him of being a Nazi is utterly groundless. He really comes out of a Eurasian Russian nationalist school of thought that develops in the 1920s, from what I've learned. And these were mostly people who were exiled. They were whites who were exiled from Russia, and they settled in France and Germany and other Western European countries. And they believed that, you know, if they could be free, someone managed to free Russia from communist control, the country could be rebuilt by creating a fruitful alliance in the East. Many of them, of course, were also imperialists. I mean, they wanted to extend Russian political control eastward. And they did not want to get involved in another war with Europe. They didn't want to fight another war with Germany because the First World War had been devastating for both sides. But the Eurasian school of thought develops in the 1920s, and they are not the same as the Pan-Slavs, who basically favor a Russian struggle against the Germans and Austrians. And they were followers of a man named Danilevsky, who wrote a famous work called Russia in the West in the early 1880s, and he saw Germany and Austria as the major enemies of Russia. The Eurasian school sort of wants to push this Russia sphere of activity eastward. They wanted to become engaged with Eastern, with Asian countries, not necessarily to conquer them. They just want to build political alliances with them against what they see as you know, unfriendly countries, or to balance the power, we might say, of what they see as, you know, Western European hegemony. And Dugin very definitely falls into this school of thought. I see no evidence that he's an atheist. I mean, this guy claims he's an atheist or believes in the devil or something like that.
We call him a Satanist.
Yeah, as far as I know, he's, you know, traditional Russian Orthodox in his religion.
Yeah, there's no evidence for that whatsoever.
No, no. I have to say my son and I had a violent argument. My son is an avid reader of National Review. He adores all their stuff on the evil Germans and Russians and generally agrees with it, and thought I was very unfair to Zubrin, who made a very good case that, you know, Dugin was poisoned by German political theory. There's absolutely no evidence he's even influenced by and the people who are cited were not Nazis.
Well, they try to say that he was influenced by Heidegger, and Heidegger was a Nazi.
Very briefly, you know, and he sort of falls out. He's only briefly a Nazi, and by 34 he becomes very critical, and he writes critically about them. He only has about 1 year, and when he seems to be sort of infatuated with the party. Yeah, but I mean, that I don't know what this proves. Heidegger is not a political theorist. He never wrote on political theory. I think that was the implicit criticism, but it was a moronic article. It was sort of hard. It was fully worthy, I think, of National Review online, which I usually find disgusting when they deal with historical topics, because there's always the same template. the evil Germans, because they're angry. The neocons are angry at the Germans because of the Nazis. So they're always evil Germans poisoning the wells for everybody. And even when you got a Russian nationalist, you know, he too is a product of the evil German mind or something like that.
They dislike both the Russians and the Germans.
Yeah, but they hate the Germans the most, I think, because of the Nazis. The Russians they don't like because they see them as anti-Semitic or something, but the Nazis really killed a lot of Jews, whereas the Russians didn't. They just kicked Jews out or something like that. These are weird prejudices that just seem to persist and take the oddest forms. I mean, it's sort of like, they sort of remind me of European anti-Semites who always found different things to blame the Jews for. The theories just keep changing, you know, but it was a kind of obsession. And these people have the same kind of sick fixation on the Germans and the Russians. They hate Putin, obviously. The statement I thought was the most remarkable, even though the source of it is a madman, was John McCain's comment about some lady who was being run to be ambassador to Hungary, that she was unfit to deal with the fascist dictatorship in Hungary, which is now in bed with the Russian dictator or something like that. Since when is Hungary a fascist dictatorship? But it's not.
Yeah, I mean, he's not even talking, I mean, the Nationalist Party, I don't agree with his assertion that Jobbik is a fascist party, but they're not even in power. It's basically like a center-right government.
That's right. That's all it is. Yeah, and, I mean, somebody in Jobbik made some remark that Jews had been communist, something that was actually true, but he was immediately, you know, attacked for saying this. I don't see how this is a fascist party. I mean, it's a ridiculous statement. It's a fascist party because it does not cooperate with American hegemons at the Wall Street Journal or on Fox News or something like that. That makes it a fascist country. Or they insist that they're not going to give gays marriage or something like that. I mean, as soon as you defy the latest model, you know, of Western progressivism, you're a fascist. And this seems to be a view shared by the left and by the neoconservatives. If you don't go with the flow, you're a fascist. Or if you're a nationalist, you're an unauthorized nationalist in some European country, that makes you a fascist. Only they can authorize nationalists. Who's allowed to be a nationalist? I find some of these statements absolutely infuriating. And when I'm told that this is the conservative opposition in the United States, and there's nothing conservative about them, they sound like left-wing lunatics most of the time.
Yeah, everything. Or the book, I'm thinking of the book by Jonah Goldberg called Liberal Fascism, where they try to link, like, they'll try to link nationalism is bad because it's on the left or something like that. Have you read that book?
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. I have a book coming out on fascism. I wrote a book on fascism, and I actually devoted almost an entire chapter to Jonah Goldberg, because he is not only stupidly and outrageously wrong, but he obviously influences tens of millions of people in this country. He's a total ignoramus on just about everything.
Another crazy example is I recently interviewed Ilana Mercer, and we discussed how this Joe Polak over at Breitbart wrote an article comparing Obama's amnesty to the apartheid regime in South Africa. Like they'll compare, or that's common. The neoconservatives will say Obama is like a fascist.
Oh yeah. Anyone they don't like is a fascist. But as I argue in my book, calling people fascists is not really saying they're on the left. Fascism means for them being on the nationalist right or something like that. I mean, that is their view of fascists, that it's a right-wing movement. They lie about it occasionally. They'll say it's a, I mean, Goldberg will tell you the leftist movement. I don't think he even really, really believes that. because most of the time they're associating with right-wing bugaboos. There was a piece by Goldberg that I once wrote a critique of that was so dumb I could not believe it. He argued that the French counter-revolutionary Joseph de Maistre was in fact a leftist because he did not believe in the doctrine of human rights and believed in a traditional, you know, in nations, peoples, or something like that. He said that I've never met a man. I've only met Frenchmen, Italians, Spaniards, Germans, etc. That showed he was a leftist. And he probably would have favored the leftist scheme of affirmative action. I mean, I have no idea how it would go best to favor affirmative action. But you know, it's sort of a game. I don't think you really believe that Mestre, who was a counter-revolutionary, in fact, a paradigmatic counter-revolutionary, was in fact a leftist. But, you know, if you can score political points that day, it's okay. But it's stupidities like people who say these stupid things have so much influence. This is what I find scary, and they speak for conservatism, which is even scarier. Being a man of the right, I'm utterly disgusted by all of this.
And they have the basically also not just that, they influence a lot of people, but they have the power to marginalize people like you.
Yes, they do that. Right, they have tremendous power.
Didn't
they have marginalized me, and they destroyed me professionally, and they destroyed other people professionally.
Who is that? Who is that prominent neocon? He called you something like he called you the court Jew for Pat Buchanan.
Oh yes, now that was Jay Nordlinger, I think, who writes for was National Review editor, and that statement got back to me. I'm sure they say much worse about me. You know, at this point, I have such boundless loathing for those people. It you know it makes no difference what they say. There's no way they can change my opinion.
Yeah, I remember you. What did you say in your interview? You did a written interview with Luke Ford. I was reading that, and you talked about how you would deal with them if you. And this is obviously you're not going to get into a position of power, but hypothetically, if you did get power, how you would deal with the neoconservatives.
What would I do? I don't know. I would take away all their money and influence and try to weaken them as much as possible. I think if there were some other, if there were a group on the right which was able to exert the kind of influence and power and had the financial resources that they do, they would quickly be replaced. You know, I don't think their harm is irreparable. The major difficulty, aside from the fact that you know personally I've suffered from them, but I mean the larger difficulty is that they help to move the political or the parameters of political discourse toward the left, right? Because they're basically on the left. So you want gay marriage, we'll give you gay marriage. Do you want amnesty? We'll give you amnesty. As long as you support the state of Israel and fight fascism in Europe or whatever they want in foreign affairs. They're willing to go along with the left. They don't fight with the left on social issues. Economic issues, they are fine, you know, unless it sort of hurts the corporate interests that pay for them.
Yeah, their economic policy, obviously, I mean, they could care less about the destruction of the middle class, but someone like Sheldon Adelson obviously wants more tax cuts for the top wealthiest.
Right, exactly. And he wants a lot of aid for Israel. That's pretty clear. Yeah. I mean, those are on social issues, he's quite liberal. And so is Rupert Murdoch, who gave a lot of money to Hillary Clinton's campaigns. So, you know, the people who are giving them money at the top are not exactly right-wingers.
Well, the term, I don't even like to use the term right-wing because it's so meaningless.
Well, I prefer using the term right-winger to, I think, the even more misleading term conservative. Because, you know, as I've argued in my books, conservatism is a 19th century ideology that develops in reaction to the French Revolution. It has nothing to do with political science today. Nor does the word liberalism have that much to do with it. You know, with all due respect to Alexander Dugin. I mean, the original brand of liberalism, the pristine liberalism, doesn't exist anymore. So that, you know, I think one has to recognize that the political battles that go on are fought between factions of the left. that basically that resemble each other, you know, but which are sort of fighting for patronage and a little more turf for their patrons. I don't see any deep ideological battle. I don't see anybody who's not on the left. It's sort of entering the approved or the sanctioned political discussion.
That's where Dugin comes in, because he diametrically opposes all of that.
I know that, yeah. And so does Heidegger. I mean, I may not agree with them on everything, but we're against the same things. And that's my position on Dugin, by the way, that, you know, I think he has some very profound insights. His book on Heidegger, I think, is very learned, you know, and shows he has a brilliant mind. His Eurasian thing, I think, is sort of like pie in the sky. But I can understand why he dislikes, you know, as a traditionalist, why he dislikes the influence of the United States in Europe.
Like, well, one example is they attack Dugin as an imperialist, but even if you want to make that argument that Dugin is an imperialist, he just wants something as a counterbalance to U.S. imperialism.
Yes. Mm-hmm, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like looking for a countervailing force. I mean, for instance, Carl Schmitt was certainly no fan of a communist, but he was always sympathetic to a bipolarity between the United States and the Soviets, because he was living in the middle of Europe and thought America had a ruinous cultural influence on Germany and also was occupying the country, whereas, you know, the Russians you know, had a dangerous, brutal, expansive tyranny in the East. So if you can sort of balance these forces, these two evils, you were okay. And I can understand that politics of, you know, balancing what the French call la politique de bascule, or basculement, you know, sort of playing off these, trying to balance the two sides. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to that position. And, of course, once the Cold War was over, you couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, and the European New Right, they came about in opposition. They came about in opposition to the United States in the Cold War. Yeah, the influence that the U.S. had over Europe.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I used to read Alain de Benoist, and I know Alain de Benoist, and I used to get copies of Duvalet Call, I'd exchange letters with him all the time when I knew my French was better then. I always thought he was crazy for making these attacks on the United States and, you know, and even having some nice thing to say about the communists as a counterbalance or the Soviets as a counterbalance to the United States. Now that the Cold War is over, I think the guy was probably right. I think he was excessive in his hatred of the United States. On the other hand, you know, I think somebody like de Gaulle was correct, you know, in not wanting the Americans to have too much influence in France. Are trying to get along with the Soviets in the East. You know, if I were a European in that time, I would have done the same thing.
What are your thoughts on the recent conflict in the Ukraine and a lot of the propaganda that's been put out about Russia in regards to the situation in the Ukraine?
Well, I think I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I have no doubt in my mind that Putin is an expansionist. He's a Russian, traditional 19th century Russian nationalist expansionist. His country lost a lot, of its territory. And, you know, while not being really a Soviet communist, he was a Russian nationalist. And, you know, he thought the disintegration of the Soviet Union was like the greatest tragedy in his life. And I think he's, you know, he'll do everything he can without causing a global conflagration to try to get back territory that they lost. And I think that's exactly what he did to the Crimea, that's what he's doing in the Ukraine. I think one has to be very careful about letting him get away with too much. On the other hand, most of the reasons that he is condemned, particularly by American puppets like Angela Merkel in Germany, make me like the guy. You know, there was a Merkel said she couldn't talk to him. I was reading this German newspaper. She could not talk to him because he doesn't understand the need for gay rights and gay marriage and so forth. Well, she was simply speaking as an American puppet. And what he said, I have to agree with entirely. You know, I thought he was right. I like the fact that he reaffirmed traditional national national identity to this country, that he's proud to be a Russian, unlike the Germans, who seem to like getting dumped on by everybody and blame themselves for every war they ever fought in. I mean, they show pride as a people, the Russians, and their leaders show pride in their Russian identity. So, you know, that I admire about Putin. What I do not like is his expansionism, because I think the Ukrainians have a right to be free. I think the Balts have a right to be free. And in the case of the Ukraine, the Soviets killed millions of Ukrainians. You know, I mean, they carried out a Holocaust in the Ukraine, although it doesn't seem to get recognized, I think. But, you know, they starved them to death. They murdered Ukrainians in the 1920s. And then they moved Russians in. They did the same thing in the Baltic countries. So, you know, I cannot overcome my sympathy for the Ukrainians or for the Balts, who were victims of the Soviet state that that Putin supported. So I am very conflicted. I mean, I do not hold the views of other paleoconservative, my paleoconservative comrades in arms, who are entirely on Putin's side. I am not. You know, I am conflicted by this. On the other hand, the people who are attacking Putin in Western countries are uniformly disgusting. Merkel, John McCain, all my least favorite people, you know, are engaging in these
kind
attacks.
Of, yeah, the enemy of your enemy is your friend.
In a sense that, you know, that is true. It's not always true. I mean, I actually sympathize with the existential threats that the Israelis face. On the other hand, most of the people representing the Israelis in the United States are thoroughly disgusting. You know, I think they're at least as bad as representatives of the Palestinian side, and a lot more powerful. But I do sympathize with the Israelis. I think they have a very bad situation on their hands. It's not entirely of their own making.
Do you think a lot of sort of paleoconservatives dislike Israel because of all these assholes like Sheldon Adelson and Chuck Schumer?
And that's the reason they dislike Israel. I mean, that's the only reason they dislike. I can't figure out any other reason they would dislike Israel. No, I mean, the Israeli government sounds like, you know, a Western nation state. They're surrounded by Muslims. They're fighting. The Israeli government is certainly not hostile to American right. I think it's the fact that Jews generally are allied with the left, but make an exception for Israel because they're Jewish nationalists. And many of the key supporters of Israel who have influenced the Republican Party are the enemies of the paleoconservatives. So, I mean, that explains it all. It's like, you know, again, what we're saying, the enemies of your enemies are your friends, or the friends of your enemies are your friends, or something like that. That's the only thing I can figure out. I mean, someone like Pat Buchanan turned around 180 degrees on Israel. And I know Buchanan. I remember when this happened, and it came, you know, after he had a fight with the New York Times Jewish editor Abe Rosenthal, who you know, attack the Polish, there was a convent in Poland near Auschwitz or something like that, and Rosenthal suggested that the Catholic Church and the Poles had killed the Jews there, or some which they had not. That was a totally tactless, stupid statement. But Buchanan just turned around, you know, and you could see, like, you know, a month later he became an enemy of Israel. So, no, I think a lot of it is just a reaction against the Jewish press in America and against the neocons. I don't think it has anything to do with Israel.
And I know the same with the neocons are also hostile towards Russia. They view Russia as an enemy of Israel. But I think it's important to point out, I mean, Russia is actually allied with the more moderate leaders in the Middle East, like Assad. Well, the U.S. supports the United States supports these really terrible people like the Salafi rebels. So Russia
right.
is behaving more rationally in the Middle East than the United States.
Yeah, but I don't think there are bad relations actually between Russia and Israel.
No, I'm not saying that, but the neocons basically specifically.
Oh, no, the neocons,
issue,
yeah, the neocons hate certain countries. They hate the Russians, not because they're anti-communist. They hate the Russians because they see them as anti-Semitic. I don't think it's anything to do with, you know, I don't think we're ever anti-communist. They just saw the Russians as anti-Jewish. And they continue to dislike Russia for the same. They also backed neoconservative Russian leaders who got destroyed by Putin. And they liked the Yeltsin government. They were backing that because they had their friends there. So, you know, they've lost the power play in Russia. I think that's a factor. They were in a much stronger position before Putin took over. So, you know, that I think is another reason they dislike the Russian government. But I don't think there's particularly bad relations between Russia and Israel, as far as I can see.
It's not so much Russia today, but it's more their historic view of Russia. They're still stuck on what happened to their grandparents who fled Russia about 100 years ago.
Well, the Israelis don't seem to care at all about that. They buy stuff from Russia. Yeah, but the neocons are stuck on that. And since they control the conservative movement and they have influence in the Republican Party, those prejudices get reflected, I would argue, in the policies that the Republicans pursue. You know, if the neocons were not there, I don't think it would be the same hostility toward Russia.
With the Middle East, what are your thoughts on why the neocons are so hostile to secular leaders like Assad, but they tolerate Saudi Arabia, for instance? What are your thoughts on that?
They don't like Saudi Arabia. I think they're sort of willing to deal with them because, you know, they can use them in a coalition every now and then. But I don't think there's any illusion. I mean, someone like Krauthammer has no illusions about Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabians are payrolling terrorists all over the place, basically to keep them taking over Saudi Arabia.
But John McCain came out in support of the rebels. He compared the rebels in Syria to the Founding Fathers. He called them freedom fighters.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is so nutty. I think McCain is almost a... he is not a Russian Jew, whatever neocons are, but he's like a creation of theirs. I mean, you know, he's like a Midwestern WASP. He's a creation of theirs. And Lindsey Graham is another one. I mean, they have to they must have massaged their brains or something. But they sound like uncontrollable neocons.
He makes them look sane in comparison.
Yes, they look sane in comparison to these political clones. Or Merkel is like such an abject. Groveling, you know, a copy of them or something. You sort of wonder. I mean, you listen to some of these Republican operatives; they actually sound worse than the neocons. You know, they're not the worst ones on the block. Not by now. I think there are people who are at least as bad.
But I noticed in the Bush era, it was easier to define who is a neocon, who's not. I noticed within the Tea Party, the lines between neocons, libertarians, other conservatives, it's more kind of blurred. Like, it's harder to tell. They're able to sort of blur the lines. Have you noticed that?
Well, what they basically did was derail or upend the Tea Party. And then they claimed that, you know, the Tea Party went into their movement or something. It was sort of like what Franco did in Spain to the Falange, or the Falangistas, that they... You know, the fascists, you know, are his allies. Then he gets rid of them all and becomes the leader, you know. He wears their symbols. He's just a military Caudillo, but he takes all the stuff. And when he gets rid of them, he pushes them out, throws them in prison, gets them out of the country. But the neocons play the same kind of game. They simply co-opt the Tea Party. Because the Tea Party would get no publicity were it not for the neocons. I mean, it's Fox News, is a neocon, you know, operation. So they, you know, the Tea Party's important, and they have neocon radio hosts and so forth. So if the neocons were to turn against the... By the way, the neocons did not like the fact that Eric Cantor, who carried a lot of water for them, got removed in Virginia. They were very upset about that.
And they didn't like... I don't know. They were worried about the guy. I think his name's David Bratt, who replaced him.
Yeah, who seems to be some kind of nonentity. But they were very upset because they liked Cantor. I mean, Cantor was their guy. And they somebody who's even worse than the neocons is that George Will. I mean, anything they say, he says. You know, but he's almost like an echo, you know, an echo with a bow tie.
Yeah.
Yeah. The more I think about, the better I like the neocons in comparison to George Will, Angela Merkel, Karl Rove, O'Reilly. They don't seem all that bad.
So you're implying that Karl Rove and O'Reilly are not neocons?
No, they're not. I mean, Rove is just an operator, as far as I can see. And probably a socially liberal operator, but, you know, he gets supported by Republican moneyed interest. O'Reilly is just as far as I can see, is sort of a regular Democrat who, you know, is a little more conservative, is a neocon on foreign policy, and, you know, dares to criticize blacks, but doesn't do a really thorough job of it. I don't see him as a neo. I mean, I don't see him as a neo. I think he has his own. I think he overlaps the neocons, and obviously he would not be on Fox News if he were not compatible with the neocons. But I think he's a kind of independent, semi-independent force, and I don't see him as a particularly conservative one at that.
I think in some ways that can be worse, because at least with a full-blown neocon, you know what you're getting.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's absolutely true. I mean, someone like Mitt Romney, I find much more upsetting than a neocon. Because, you know, he's a country club Republican, and they stand for nothing, you know, but looking out for certain business interests. But because they're Republicans, they're considered on the right, you know, by the media, the liberal and the so-called conservative media. They immediately become like, Bush is considered to be a right-wing president or a conservative president. I have no idea what makes him a conservative, except that he had a neocon foreign policy. But I would agree with you. I think that these people that they sort of pull in were not full-fledged neocons, but at least as much a problem with the neocons themselves.
And you have the same thing where also in the Democratic Party, people where the neocons overlap with the left, and then you have Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Hillary Clinton would be perfect for them. I mean, there was something in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago that I read, that in which major backers of the Republican Party, I suppose Sheldon Adelson was among them, said that if they made Rand Paul the nominee, they would back Hillary Clinton. And that didn't surprise me at all, you know, because Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, they're the same. I mean, what is the difference in terms of their policies? But, yeah, they probably wouldn't like Elizabeth Warren because she's more anti-capitalist, I suppose, or against big banks or investors or something like that. But Hillary Clinton would suit them fine.
Well,
yeah, the next election, you'll have a choice between Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, you know.
We touched on this, but with the neoconservative economic policy, that's not, I mean, they're more most vocal about foreign policy and also immigration, but you'd say that their main economic policy is concern for keeping taxes low on the billionaires, basically. So that's why they might not, that's why they're kind of iffy about Elizabeth Warren. But even then,
right,
with
no,
Elizabeth
not...
Warren, that could just be a rhetoric. I don't know how serious she is about it.
They would not like Elizabeth Warren. But if you notice, on every social issue, they just cave in. You know, gay marriage, cave. Then you start getting judges, including Republican judges, saying that, you know, gay marriage is covered by the 14th Amendment. Fox News is quiet about it. That's fine. They don't care. You know, that's not an issue for them. However, if the CIA has some files released, they go crazy. You know, I mean, or there's some foreign policy involvement, like helping the rebels in Syria. They'll go crazy about that. But you can see social issues are a low priority. They oppose Obama's executive order, but they're quite comfortable with amnesty. That's not a problem. They just want the Congress to do the amnesty.
No, they're totally for amnesty, but they just criticize Obama on that because they want to appeal to their base.
Right. But if you notice, even when they criticize Obama, it's mostly like Obamacare. Like, you know, the provisions of Obamacare, they're bad. I mean, they just constantly harp on Obamacare. Well, that's because they can get votes out of it and don't really have to do anything. I mean, what are they going to do when they get in? I mean, he's still the president. They're not going to be able to repeal it. So they can talk about it for 2 years. They're going to milk that issue for everything it's worth. And in the end of the end of the day, they'll probably land up just saying we can manage it better, or we're going to get rid of some provision in it. We'll make a compromise with Obama. But the much more important concern, I think, is the sort of far liberal internationalist interventionism. That's much more important to them.
What are their big foreign policy goals right now in the Middle East and in other parts of the world? Their biggest foreign policy objectives?
Well, who are the they, first of all?
The neoconservatives.
Well, you know, I think what they want is simply constant involvement, you know. My friend Jim Kalb says they sort of remind you of fascists in the sense that the fascists were like pure energy. They want to always be involved, want to be active, or something like that. Just want to spin their wheels. Well, the neocons just want to spin wheels. You know, they want to be involved everywhere in Syria. They want to be involved in the Ukraine. Could you imagine if McCain had become president of the United States? By now, we'd have at least 12 wars going, maybe 20 wars going. I mean, there's no place where he doesn't want to send, you know, military support, possibly, you know, possibly resulting in the need for ground troops. But
we could very well be in war with Russia, even if McCain were president. I mean, he'd be a lot. He'd be even worse. He'd be worse than Obama.
He'd be much worse than Obama. No, I say in retrospect, I'm glad that my vote for him in 2008 didn't count and Obama won. I think he's much more dangerous than Obama. I also don't see him as any kind of social conservative. I think on every domestic issue, he would just give way, you know, and in return, he would want to, you know, pursue this very aggressive, militaristic foreign policy.
How much
with neoconservative advisors.
With Russia, how big of a conflict? I mean, obviously, I don't think we're going to get into a full-blown war, but we could go into a second Cold War. That could be very likely.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that it will go much beyond sanctions and sending armaments to Ukrainians or something like that. And the reason it won't is I don't think the American public wants it. And the American public wants more social programs. If you give them more gay marriage or transgender marriage, you know, that to them is a non-issue. The immigration, they favor amnesty. They just don't like the executive order, you know. And basically, public consciousness or public opinion is being constantly reshaped by a basically leftist media and educational establishment. But they don't want a war. And I don't think the Republicans would do well by getting involved. And someone like McCain, I think, would be uncontrollable. I mean, that's Romney. I think might be, you know, might be a little more cautious. Certainly, Bush was not, and he became very unpopular because of the war of choice against Iraq.
And
it was an entirely avoidable war.
Back to the issue of Dugin. They're vastly overestimating Dugin's influence, but
right.
They've tried to say that they're almost trying to say Putin is a puppet of Dugin, or that
mm-hmm.
Dugin is his main advisor. I think
right.
They have had meetings before, but Dugin's influence, he has a decent-sized following, but he's far from being this major power broker in Russia that they make him out to be.
I don't see any indication of that. You know, he's sitting around writing books on Heidegger or something and going around to giving conference speeches or something. I cannot think of anything. I mean, I don't know the inner workings of the Kremlin, but, you know, it doesn't like he influenced the war against, the involvement in eastern Ukraine or the taking of the Crimea. His major interest is actually the East. You know, he wants to make alliances with China or something against with Japan, against the United States. He's not interested in expanding westward. There's no indication, as far as I can see, that he influences.
Well, I will say he has more influence in Russia than the paleoconservatives have in America. You could say that for sure.
Well, paleoconservatives have no influence, but I doubt he has the influence that the neoconservatives have in America. You know, the neoconservatives are very powerful, and it's not just in the Republican Party, because they write for the Washington Post, they write for the New York Times, they got invited on liberal programs, they reciprocate on Fox News. I mean, they do very well, you know, in their relation with liberals, and their liberal internationalist foreign policy follows very closely, you know, the positions I see in foreign affairs and other, you know, this sort of American liberal internationalist interventionism has become the shared foreign policy of both parties. I mean, all I can say about Obama is that he's not as vigorous in pursuing it, but, you know, he talks about the same things, gets the same speeches about, you know, how America must spread its values, its democracy, its human rights. I don't hear any other thing coming from him.
Yeah, like they say that Obama is not patriotic, but their definition of Americanism or patriotism is very similar. So they're totally
contradictory. There is no difference. It's
no.
Just a difference of degree or of screaming or something. They scream it more. No, I mean, and it's the same propositional nationhood and, you know, the abstract humanity and saving the world with American democracy, the same junk, you know, and that's the exceptionalism. That's what our exceptionalism consists of. There isn't any major difference. I mean, they do not represent a dialectical opposite to what we now have. They just represent a much more aggressive version of it.
We're getting towards the end of the show. Is there anything else you would like to add, either about the topic of neoconservatism or about Dugin that we didn't touch upon?
Well, one of the points that I think I did make about Dugin is that he's basically a scholar, and he has written very knowledgeably on philosophy, and having written that introduction to his study of Heidegger, it's a very long study, I came away very impressed by his erudition in philosophy. I don't think anybody with that learning has ever, you know, has not written for National Review since the neocons purged us, like in the 1980s. but, you know, it's anybody with that kind of depth of understanding, you know, of probably the most difficult the most difficult traditional philosopher that I've ever read was Heidegger. It impresses me deeply, and he is a significant thinker. Even though I think his Eurasian concept, you know, is an idea that whose time has come and gone, but I came away from reading his work with a heightened respect for the man.
And one more thing is your next book is coming out on the topic of fascism.
Right.
What is the title of that, and when is that coming out?
It's called Fascism, the Career of a Concept. Now, I don't know who the publisher is going to be. It might be Cambridge, and then the backup is Northern Illinois University Press.
Have you thought about Arctos?
I think I mentioned it to them at one point, because I know Morgan, John Morgan, who's the editor. And, you know, I sort of played around with that idea. But they are doing something else. They're doing a translation into Swedish of my book, The Strange Death of European Marxism. I think they may be translating more than one of my books. So, you know, I think they have enough Gottfried works going at the moment. And I thought this was a book that was more suited for traditional academic press.
So, Paul Gottfried, I would like to thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.